and welcome to Through the Pinard, your conversational podcast talking to midwives around the world about the research they are doing to improve midwifery practice. This research can range from small quality improvement programs and projects to those starting partway through or just finishing their postgraduate studies, and to those that have been there, done that, and got the t-shirt. So settle back and enjoy the conversation. And remember, you can continue the conversation on Twitter after you finish listening. Thank you very much for joining me today. As per usual, can you introduce yourself, please?
Oh, hi, everybody. I'm Mary Sidebotham. I'm currently a title holder professor of midwifery at Griffith University. So up till December, I worked there full time and ran the postgrad program. So here I am. I'm looking forward to the journey.
So you've been able to see research, midwifery research, from both sides, from doing it yourself and now helping others go through it.
Oh, definitely. And it's great being in the title holder position because it means that I've still got PhD students, I'm still working on projects, but I don't have all the other distractions.
Which definitely are far too much in academia sometimes.
I agree.
When you just want to kind of concentrate on the studies and the students, and it's like politics and writing and all the other stuff that comes into it. So you started your midwifery career back in where? It wasn't Australia.
No, it wasn't Australia. Back in England, back in the day, and a long time ago, when you finished your nursing training, to finish you off, you were supposed to go and do midwifery. And I was working on an orthopaedic ward, and it was really hard work. So my friend who'd already been accepted for midwifery said, oh, come and do midwifery. So it seemed like a good idea at the time. I thought I'd do the 18. I was a bit annoyed because they'd just increased the training from 12 months to 18 months. I thought, yeah, I'll do that. And then I'll get a sister's post back in general nursing. And that was, I was never at that time drawn to midwifery. And I went over, and the very first placement you did as a student midwife, you were attached to a community midwife 5 days a week for 3 months. Absolutely changed my life. Changed my life. I can feel myself getting all tingly and teary thinking about it. Being out in the community with families, with women, I knew that this was what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And there were moments throughout my career when, you know, wise midwives said to me, you'll never be able to go back. You know that, don't you? And that was a moment. So thank you, Sister Keane. Thank you, Sister Jones. You changed my life.
I love those stories. I love that serendipitous kind of like experience that kind of comes out the blue and just completely flattens you in another direction.
There's a fantastic midwifery leader here in Queensland, Kathy Stiles, and she says, leap and a net will appear. And and I think that's what I've done. And, you know, that's how I got into a PhD. That's more or less how I got to Australia. That's how I got into teaching. And, you know, some of those nets were a bit dodgy and a bit ropey, but most of them have bound me up and cushioned me, and it's been fabulous.
So did you do any postgraduate studies when you're still in the UK?
I did. I did two certificates. So I did a certificate in nursing, then a certificate in midwifery, because there was no such thing as a degree in either. Well, there was a degree in nursing at Manchester University. But then there was something called the Advanced Diploma in Midwifery, and that was what you did. You know, if you were going to go and do postgrad studies, you went and did that. And round about the time I did it, it became a tertiary qualification, not just at the School of Midwifery at St. Mary's Hospital. They'd moved into the university by then. And I absolutely loved it. It was fabulous. But then after that, when I did the advanced diploma of midwifery, it was when the British Journal of Midwifery had just been launched.
Oh, wow.
And I was working in a busy labour ward, as they called them back then, in Manchester. And all of my colleagues who I'd worked with for years up to this point were very, well, you know, it's not going to make you any difference. And there was this big divide at the time between those who'd done a certificate and those who were getting a bit above themselves and thinking they were off to do university studies and would it make you any different. And there was a real sense of threat around at that time, because people were just about starting to move into academia and seeing the value. So I actually wrote an editorial, and it was the very first paper I ever had published. And it was called Academic Degrees or Clinical Expertise.
Nice.
And it was published, and it upset everybody. So in this editorial, I wrote that I'd felt compelled to do this postgrad study because I had this sense that, you know, people coming up behind me were going to be more qualified than me if I didn't. But at the same time, I didn't want to devalue these amazing clinicians who'd shaped me for the last 10 years.
Yep.
So I remember Margaret Lynch, who was the most amazing midwifery tutor at St. Mary's Hospital, Manchester, saying to me, "Why did you write this?" And then going back and amazing, amazing midwives back on the labour ward saying, "You're getting a bit uppity about yourself, aren't you?" But in a nice way. And it was like this spark moment for me that I realised that was just something that at the time it was very relevant, it was very topical, and I felt very passionate about it and just wrote about it. Never in a million years did I expect them to publish it, but they did. So then after I'd finished that, I then, again, Leap and Annette will appear. I saw an advert in the Midwives Chronicle that said, "Where are the midwifery leaders in Britain?" And the Royal College of Midwives ran their inaugural leadership program, and I got a place on it.
Nice.
So it really started wakening me up to the world of possibility. And I thought, I want to do a degree, but really, why would I go and do? Because they were just establishing then, if you'd done the Advanced Diploma of Midwifery, it was now called Diploma Professional Midwifery Studies, you could do a few more modules and turn that into a Bachelor of Midwifery. And I thought, I don't want to do more of the same just to have a degree. So I went to Manchester University and I did a Master's in Healthcare Law and Ethics.
Nice.
And I did my dissertation with the amazing Dame Margot Brazier. Mm-hmm. And she was my very first supervisor. And my dissertation topic was commerce, cash or care. Because
highly relevant now.
Well, at that time, I was really, really interested in assisted fertility, because St. Mary's Hospital, Manchester, where I worked, had the very first NHS test tube baby. And I worked on that ward, and I worked with an amazing obstetrician called Brian Lieberman, who set the NHS service up. Mm-hmm. So, and somehow I ended up chair of a charity that was seeking to increase the number of egg and sperm donors coming to provide support. And somehow I ended up doing a national survey of all the heifer, all the licensed clinics offering treatments, and looked at what motivated egg donors. Mm-hmm. So that was why it was called Commerce, Cash or Care. And that was my master's project. So absolutely nothing really to do with midwifery, but very, very much to do with women and life and ethics. And it was fascinating. It was a brilliant degree to do. So,
but it's almost like pre-midwifery, because without that, without conception, there is no midwifery, regardless of how conception occurs.
But it was kind of like when I did the Advanced Diploma of Midwifery Psychology subject, my study for that was, is there such a thing as the IVF personality? And that's when I came first of all across Barbara Katz Rothman's work. And also I remember reading The Tentative Pregnancy and Renata Klein's work and realizing that it doesn't really matter how you become pregnant. If you are a person who's going to be anxious, you're going to be anxious and you're going to need support. So it taught me a lot. And it also taught me about presumptions and stereotypes. But it also made me, you always just want to know more. And many years later, I was in New York with some fabulous midwives, and they invited me to dinner and said, oh, we hope you don't mind, but we've invited a non-midwife because she wanted to meet you. And in walked Barbara Katz Rothman. And you know when you you know when you get that, like, oh my God, moment of absolute awestruck.
Yep.
It was oh my goodness me. And you know, I had to almost stop myself bowing. But you know, I think that's the joy of this role, isn't it? You really never know where your work's going to take you. You never know. You read these people's work and you revere them, and then they turn out to be just, you know, fabulous, not ordinary people. I would never call somebody like Barbara Katz Rothman ordinary, but humans.
Approachable. Yeah.
Humans who are just as willing to share as anyone else. So, yeah, it's been a fabulous journey, and most of it unplanned. And I suppose that's how I got into a PhD as well.
So did you start your PhD there or when you came here, down to Oz?
No, I came to Australia because a number of friends from St Mary's Hospital Manchester had all moved over to Australia and all told me, oh, it's fantastic, you should definitely come. So I came on holiday and my son fell in love with it. My ex-husband said we should go. So, and I was in a really, really, you know, very, very high pressured, high profile job at the time. I was a consultant midwife for a large trust in the northwest of England. And it was a great job. And I had, you know, responsibility for promoting normal birth and, you know, transforming services. And it was hard and I was tired. And I said, well, if we go, I'm not doing a high profile job. I'm just going to be an ordinary midwife working in, yep. You know, preferably. And I had no idea what I was coming to, because the best job I'd ever had was as a caseload midwife. And I thought, I'll do that. That's what I'll do. I'll go to Australia and I'll do that. Had no idea what I was coming to. And I came to Australia and the first job I got was in a hospital, and it was so confronting and so different to what I was used to, that when I saw an advert in the paper that said, are you interested in the recruitment and something of midwives? If you are, contact this person. And it said APAI 25,000 plus top up, and I had no idea what this meant.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, it's not a lot of money, but perhaps I could be a research assistant and I'm interested in the topic. I'll apply. So I went along for a meeting with Professor Kathy Turner, and she told me about this big grant she had for an e-cohort study, and I'm thinking, oh, this is all very interesting. And then she started telling me about a survey she was putting together. And I'm wondering, you know, well, where would my job be? So she's saying, you know, what are you interested? Are you interested in this? And I'm interested in that. And I'm definitely interested in, you know, why midwives are coming to Australia. And she said, is this you? And she pulled up a PubMed thing that had got all these publications, because it before I did the consultant midwife job, I worked for the perinatal epidemiology unit as the research midwife for 4 years and ran a couple of the big KESDI studies. Yep. So But it had never been important. You know, it never seemed to me to be important that I just wrote because I did.
Yep.
Anyway, I said, yeah, that's me. And she said, and is this your thesis? Yeah, that's my thesis. And then she said to me, well, she said, I definitely think you would be definitely suitable to do your PhD with us. And I looked at her and I went, PhD? Oh, yeah. She said, I'm sorry that we, you know, the scholarship is only $25,000 a year, but we'll top it up with the school scholarship. And I'm going, just a minute, PhD? I had absolutely no idea that APAI meant Australian Postgrad Award Industry. And I was there discussing whether or not I could do a PhD and get one of the most prestigious scholarships in Australia. So leap and Annette will appear. Thank you, Kathy.
Certainly did.
You've never seen me leap so quick. Oh, yes, I'll do that. So so I joined the e-cohort study and I looked at what, because at the time, this was 2005, 2006-ish, we were recruiting like mad from the United Kingdom.
Yeah.
And we had no idea what was happening to these midwives when they were coming into the Australian system. And so I thought I would do my PhD and look at what motivated midwives to come to Australia and what was their experience when they came. So that's what I did.
And so that was full-time because you had the scholarship?
Yeah. It was full-time, but I had to take a little break because I had a change of direction and moved from doing it quantitatively through the survey because that there just weren't going to be enough numbers for it to be statistically significant. And I moved and did a phenomenology study instead. So,
okay. So what did you do with that?
I just interviewed. I interviewed 18 midwives who'd migrated and worked out what the main, you know, what drove them to come and what their experience was when they came.
So what was their perception versus their reality? Because I know you've mentioned a big shock working in the Australian system compared to the UK system. I know other people who've come over this way who have gone, your scope of practice is so restricted. So what was their perception of what they were coming to? So what did you find?
There were absolutely the main reason why people came was for lifestyle, and very few of them had actually thought about actually being a midwife in another country because it was the draw of a better life that drew people here. And then the experience fell into three main themes. There were those that tried but just couldn't adapt, so they found other things to do that weren't midwifery. And a lot depended on what kind of visa they had as to what choice they had. And then there were the group that came, were initially shocked but thought, no, sod it, the lifestyle's fabulous, and they capitulated. And the interesting thing was that they were really triggered by the interviews.
Oh.
And I interviewed everybody twice, and they said that whereas they felt that they'd adapted, they felt conflicted again.
Ooh.
And that's why it's so important that when we're doing this sort of research, we take seriously what we say about not creating harm and then guiding people towards support if we do trigger things that make people feel uncomfortable. And then the biggest theme was those that decided to join the system but join the movement towards change. And you'll probably remember that around about 2005, 2006, 2007, 2008, it was very exciting. Midwifery was really emerging and growing and strengthening. we were getting the first B mids. We were just pre the changes to the national law where midwifery was going to be recognised as a separate profession at last. We'd got resistance to closing birth centres in a number of states, and it was a really exciting time. And a lot of these midwives that I interviewed felt that the way to deal with how different things were was to join in and mm-hmm. to become part of that growing group seeking change. So, yeah, it's interesting.
Where has that taken you now? So where have you gone, or how have you extended that PhD?
Well, obviously, because of it, I became really, really interested in not just in the well-being of the midwifery workforce, but also in the active movement of what was going on in midwifery in Australia. And I was very, very lucky. I was in Queensland and met some, as soon as I moved over here, ICM was on, and I was on council at ICM for one of the UK member organisations. So because of that, I was introduced to some midwifery leaders. And one of the people I was introduced to was Teresa Walsh. And Teresa took me to my first Australian College of Midwives meeting, where I met Jenny Gamble and mm-hmm. Hazel Brattain. So before I knew it, and Joss Tuhill, before I knew it, I was on the Queensland Committee for the College and meeting fabulous people and really, really getting involved in the political scene yeah. of transforming birth services and transforming midwifery. And it was very, very exciting. So when I finished my PhD, I remember Jenny Gamble inviting me out for lunch and saying, I just wondered what you were thinking of doing. You've finished your PhD. And they were just starting a Bachelor of Midwifery at Griffith University. Mm-hmm. So I was successful in getting a position there, and I was there for 11 years. So I was part of the launch of the BMID, and then we decided to be ambitious and offer a prescribing course. And then following on from that, I developed and launched the Master of Primary Maternity Care. And it was all wrapped around, it was the vehicle to promote maternity reform across mm. Australia. So in those intervening years from the PhD, I had the opportunity to work with just amazing people. I still pinch myself sometimes that I've worked internationally with a group of amazing people. Initially led by Jenny Fenwick, we set up the Work, Health and Emotional Lives of Midwives project. And we've ran the WELM survey now in a number of countries. And, the latest big launch was in the United Kingdom, where we worked with Billy Hunter and saw that the results of doing that work, where we identify the stressors and the impact of those stressors on midwives' mental health, that enable, because we've got quantitative measurements using validated tools, that we've been able to revalidate the tools and provide the evidence that's not just hearsay anymore. But the most exciting thing that's come from the WELM survey and the WELM work is that we can now finally prove that working in shift work is more likely to cause burnout mm-hmm. than working in continuity. And, mm-hmm. When you're waiting for the amazing Julie Pallant to run the stats, because Julie Pallant wrote SPSS for Dummies. And if anybody knows what they're doing, then it's her. And it's like, we all had our fingers crossed every time. But when she said, yep, it's so in New Zealand and in Australia and in other countries, we've shown now that you are less likely to be stressed, anxious, burnt out, demotivated, disempowered if you're working in a continuity model than if you're working in a traditional shift-based model. And that was really exciting because one of the reasons that people were anecdotally saying, I don't want to go into an on-call model is because I don't want to be on call. But what we found from some of the questions from the WELM survey, that people working in shift work avoided answering their phone. They were fearful of the phone ringing because it was so short-staffed in a lot of the units that they were being asked to do extra shifts. And when you're being asked to do extra shifts in a shift-based model, it's because it's really, really busy and you're going into the abyss. Mm. Whereas if you're answering the phone in a caseload model, if it's properly organized and structured caseload model, you go into someone you know.
Mm.
So it's not as stressful. And to be able, probably that's been one of the highlights of the research work I've done, to be able to categorically say that that myth is now debunked.
So how do we change the system? Like we've got so much evidence that we've collected over the last kind of couple of decades. And this is one of the conversations that I had with Franca when we were talking about the ICM declaring this is the decade of midwifery research, and that coming up to 2030, when we look back at all the changes that we've done because of research, is going to be exciting. But how do we use this research and what we've got on continuity of care for the benefits of women to change the system?
That's a great segue into why have I focused so much of my research on education, because I absolutely truly believe in the transformative potential of education. And that's why we launched and wrote the Master of Primary Maternity Care. Because thinking back to all those years ago, academic degrees or clinical expertise, those expert midwives were expert midwives, but they worked in the way and in the model they did because that's all there was and that's all they knew, and they couldn't envisage anything different. So therefore, they weren't going to fight for anything different. Whereas when you've glimpsed at something different and you've had the courage to do it, you can see the potential of possible.
Mm.
But I knew we were never going to be able to transition to a different model of maternity care if we didn't have a willing workforce to be able and willing to give it a go. And what I did witness was that if people don't know something, then they're fearful of it and become defensive of what they've got. And I think that's what we were seeing. So being able to safely show people something different, even if they've not personally experienced it, might whet their appetite to want to.
Mm.
And so one of the big things, and we were really pleased when the Lancet series was published, because we could then take the framework and use that to wrap the program around. And so I think that's been inspirational, seeing midwives, seeing that light bulb moment, the light bulb moment I had when I had the opportunity to work with, you know, if you said to me which midwife has been the person who's inspired you the most, it would be Judith Curitash. Okay. And Judith Curitash used to be the manager on the labor ward when I was at St. Mary's Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And before I'd done the ADM or anything else, she left and became an independent midwife. And at the time, I remember thinking she was barking mad. But then I remembered how much I loved being a community midwife and how I really, really, well, as a student, I should say, and how that was my dream job. But it was like, you know, there's a saying in England that's dead man's shoes. Everybody who was a community midwife loved it. They weren't expanding the service despite opportunities from changing childbirth. So it was like hen's teeth trying to get one of those jobs. Mm. and I had three small children at the time, but there was this, you know, the midwifery manager called me one day and said, we're sending you out on a job. And I knew at the time they really wanted this project to fail. It was called the Cathalot Project. And it was way, way before its time. And it was providing caseload care from a community base, a community-led organization, partnering with an independent midwife to provide caseload care for vulnerable women. So our client group were substance abusers, refugees, and women with mental health problems.
So only the group of women who could really, really benefit from continuity.
But there was really no such thing as a what I would call a true caseload model at the time. Great community midwifery services, but very different to this model of full continuity. So and the person I worked with was Judith Kuratash. And that's the second time that Judith said to me, be very sure, because you will never be able to go back into the hospital system when you do this work. And it was without a doubt the most joyous time of my whole career. I met amazing women. I learned so much about myself. And I realized that I would advocate for this to my dying day.
Yeah.
And I thought, if I can be switched on from that, you know, super midwife of the labor ward, thinking I was queen bee because I could get, you know, I could get a fetal scalp electrode onto a baby's head if the cervix admitted a fetal scalp electrode. And I just thought, oh my goodness me, where did this happen? How did I become this person that was so part of that system when my original love was this? And I get tearful just thinking about it because I was so happy. And as always happens with project funding, they pulled the funding just as it was really established and doing great work, and I couldn't go back. So that's when I went into the KESDI role for 4 years. And then I went into a job where I had the opportunity and I was the person who made things happen. And in Stockport, we opened a midwifery-led service and I transformed that into a caseload service at Buxton. And we increased our home birth rate to 10%, which at the time for England was absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
We were pioneers in water birth in Buxton. So that's what I came from. So obviously I was definitely looking for my tribe, and I found them. And what I wanted to do was to, within education and knowing about how people wanted to migrate and find each other from a PhD, was provide a forum where we could bring people who've got ideas, who can make change happen, bring them together, and then empower them. And you empower people with knowledge and with skills, and then you drive the research. But you don't just drive the research. You also need those strong, politically aligned clinicians and leaders. And what I've just finished work with Joy Adcock, one of our master's students, and her thesis was, what do midwifery leaders need in order to promote maternity reform?
Oh, nice.
So I think that what you say is right, Liz. You're shaped by the work you do, and your tentacles go out, but you have to have this central theme. And that's why, you know, I'm so proud to have been one of the founders, really, of the Transforming Maternity Care Collaborative, which is growing, and the bigger umbrella organization is looking at transforming maternity care. And within that, we have the Trans-Tasman Midwifery Education Consortium.
Yep.
And that started as an idea, me and Jenny saying, who are our mates? Who could we get? Who could we get in this? And of course, you know, we went over to our mates in New Zealand, and we thought, Deb Davies, Jenny Brown, they'll be up for this. South Australia, they're a feisty lot, we'll get them in. And we wanted to become the organisation that everybody wanted to join. And now, as you know, everybody's joined.
And I must admit, being one of the Flinders representatives on that, is I love sitting there, and basically it is like the who's who of midwifery in Australia when you're looking at the professors and the deans that are there. And I just sit there and go, the same thing, I'm not worthy of being there. I kind of just sit there in awe. But it is the passion that comes out of every single kind of like person in that. I think they're mostly women. We've got a couple of blokes that come on. But the passion that comes out of that TMEC, it's about transforming education. It's about getting it from the undergraduate to the postgraduate and beyond, is just, it's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant to see that and to be able to step aside and see the passion, and knowing that, as we all know, midwifery is political. It's political personally, it's political as state, it's politically nationally, and it's politically international. So to see that and be a part of it is kind of quite an honour from my little point of view, from my little world down here. So I thank you for starting.
Oh, it's a pleasure. And it's all part of that. Everything's a vehicle. Mm. Everything's a vehicle to transform maternity services. And it became very real to me when my daughter had a baby, and I was panicking, thinking, how are we going to make sure she gets the right care? And I knew I absolutely knew she had to have her own midwife. Mm-hmm. And I knew it couldn't be me because I wanted to be a mum. And honestly, I'm just using this as a platform really to say, Diane Tamariki, thank you. You know, I feel privileged to have had these amazing midwives come into my life, and I'm convinced that Diane Tamariki saved my daughter's life, empowered her, birthed her as a woman, all of those things that she did that made my daughter's birth so empowering and fabulous, and birthed her as a woman. Really believe that, and I am grateful to her every day. So, celebration of amazing midwives.
And that's what every woman should experience. And we know that within Australia, we've got, 0.3% of home births, a minuscule number of home births that happen in this country. We have less than 10% of women who have access to a continuity of care model.
Oh, it's increased in Queensland.
Queensland.
Thank you, Jocelyn Toohill. We're up to about 20% here now.
Queensland, I had the privilege of going and presenting at a Queensland ACM conference in early 2019, so before when we could still travel. And I went up there presenting my military midwifery paper. And it was the first time that I'd been up to Rockhampton and got to meet Michelle Gray and like everyone up there in Queensland. And it was such an eye-opener that I keep telling people now, if you have a chance, go visit another state's conference. Because I, geographically, yes, I knew Queensland was a big state, but I was also geographically embarrassed, shall we say, that I kept thinking, and I was centric, that Brisbane centric, forgetting the fact that that's like 5% of the state and the rest of the state is considered rural and remote. And some of the things that they were doing out there was just mind-boggling, and it was like it was ahead of its time. So I can see why there's so many strong Queensland midwives and so many passionate and political Queensland midwives.
Oh, well, and I'm so proud that so many of them have done our program. So Gemma McMillan, who is leading the rollout of continuity of care across the Torres Strait, she is phenomenal. But we, you know, we've got an amazing director of midwifery here as well, Jocelyn Toohill, who is, God, she's a feisty woman, and she's driven, absolutely driven, and we're lucky because we've got great leaders. Mm. Hazel Brittain, everywhere Hazel works, she transforms what's before her, and so she will get the Gold Coast up to 50% continuity. Mm. I have absolutely no doubt she'll do that, and she's growing this emerging band of leaders behind her. And she's another one, you know, when I was doing my PhD, she sent me off to, I worked at Emerald and I worked at Charleville, because she gets these messages saying we're desperate for a midwife to come out, do you know anyone? And she'd tell me, it's good for you, it will ground you, it will shape you, leap and a net will appear. So off I went. And I think it's people, visionaries, you know, visionaries, and that's what we need to open our hearts to. And we none of this can be done alone.
No,
none of this can be done alone. We need the alliance of the willing. That's a Jenny Gamble statement. and this is what we find. We find ourselves in a nice sort of group speak.
Yeah. Absolutely. I must admit, I keep finding myself now saying more and more, Jan Sandel has said that every woman deserves a midwife. Every woman needs a midwife. Some women need a doctor. Trying to get back to that kind of, like, I think my students are sick of me saying that. But it is. It's that reality that we have to change the perspective that it's not a medicalized process. It is a natural physiological process for majority of women, but others just need some extra help, that they have a team around them as well, same as we have a team.
Yeah. And how fantastic now that we've got the Lancet framework to demonstrate it and show it visually. We've got that tiny little corner on, I can see it in front of me on the top right hand corner. Only this number needs to see a doctor. But it's really important that we acknowledge that and we respect that. Bottom line, learn to work together.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's really important when you're doing postgraduate studies. And I think that's something that so many people forget, that they've gone through undergraduate studies, that they've done it very much themselves. And then the postgraduate is much more team orientated. And so the looking at that support and picking supervisors and picking teams and universities where you go to. You mentioned that you went off and did some locum work while you were doing your PhD. What else did you do to kind of like maintain sanity when it got too bad, so you weren't kind of sitting and rocking in the corner? Not that there's anything wrong with sitting and rocking in the corner sometimes.
Well, at the time, I was so involved in the college and birth activism that I had a great group of friends, family, and a passion, really, a passion to... This is going to sound terrible as well. It was the same as when I did my A-levels in England. I didn't need them. So I didn't see myself having a career that needed a PhD.
Yep.
So there was no pressure on me to get a PhD. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So I did it purely because I was really interested in what I was doing. And I enjoyed it, but it didn't actually matter if I didn't get it. I had absolutely no idea how valuable it was.
Mm.
And until I got it, and then I saw the doors it opened, the opportunities it provided. If I'd have known all that before, I'm not so sure I would have coped as well.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. So what do you think was the benefit of it then? So the apart from the research kind of experience, and what did you see as the greatest benefit of it?
People listen. When I know that's sad, but when you introduce yourself as doctor, people listen. I went to China. I did a 3-province tour of China, and I don't think they realised I was a midwife. Mm. They just knew I was, you know, associate professor and doctor. And so I had the opportunity. I went into hospitals. I spoke to politicians. I was courted by the obstetricians. And I had the opportunity to be consulted and to be heard.
Yeah.
And I think it was the title, not me, that they were deferring to. But that didn't matter, because what they got was me.
Yeah. And I've had several people who've said similar things, that to be taken seriously, they needed that doctor, because that put them on the equal playing field, that even though it was their experience as a midwife that came out, they weren't being taken experience when it was introducing of doctor this, professor this, and then Miss so-and-so. It's like you're automatically dismissed. But when you're introduced as doctor, it is like you have that right to be there, even though we should. But this kind of power balance perception.
I know. And I hate that we live in that world, but I can remember all those years ago when I did that inaugural leadership program and the people who were facilitating it. I remember the first task they gave us was to go back to our employing organizations, get an appointment with the chief executive officer and go and introduce ourselves. But what they said was, do not go in uniform, introduce yourself by your first name, address them by their first mm-hmm. name, and when you shake hands, get your thumb on top of the handshake.
Yep.
And I've never forgotten that. So when I went to Griffith, I introduced myself to the vice chancellor and called him by his first name, shook hands with him, got my thumb on top. And the other thing that they said was tell them something that will flatter them, but make them remember you.
Yep.
So I knew that the vice chancellor at the time was from UQ and that his background was social work. So I made sure I told him how, you know, it was great to be at this university where my daughter was doing her social work degree, even though she had an OP1 and had the opportunity to go to UQ. She'd chosen to come to Griffith because she'd heard it was a great. And I could see thinking, oh, that's fantastic. And he remembered me.
Yep.
So it was always, it was great advice, but. And it was also made me realize that you have to play the game a bit. And much as your principals might not want you to do that, if you want to be heard, you know, I was taught how to speak to politicians, how to pitch, how to make sure that you've got your three, you know, remember on the leadership program, don't waffle, 3 points, yeah. No more, and reiterate the 3 points. So that was how we used to pitch with politicians.
And I think that reinforces the need for us to actually have those wider qualifications, those more generic qualifications that come from business that are outside of midwifery, even things like MBAs, all of that knowledge that is what the rest of the world uses that doesn't necessarily get taught in midwifery, but it's essential for us to know because we're actually relating to the rest of the world. And other businesses and politicians and governments and all of that things that we need to be able to communicate with to actually change the system.
And this is why I think that we should be teaching midwifery students to be political. We should be. And it's so important that you learn to use your voice. You learn about the wider influences on maternity service provision because it's only when you know the wider influences that you can influence them. Mm.
Yes, very much so. Okay, this is going to sound like a completely frivolous question, but it's highly important. How did you celebrate your finishing of your PhD?
It was quite funny, really. I got my email that said, basically, the email said minor corrections. So because I'm a bit of a pessimist, I remember going knocking on Jenny Gamble's door because I knew that you know, that it was really important by now. I've got, because I'd submitted my PhD before I started the job. And I went and said to Jenny, oh, you know, I'm really sorry, but I've not passed. And she went, what? Show me the email. So I showed her the email and she went, yippee! And she went and got her PhD gown and cap that she had hung on the back of the door, dressed me in it, paraded me around the department, and then found a bottle of wine somewhere. And that was the, I said, I can't do this, I've not passed yet. Nonsense, she said, comma here, full stop there. And that was the first celebration. So again, you know, and just amazing people who've guided me, supported me, picked me up. I honestly thought this was a disaster and I hadn't, and I hadn't passed. And it was literally typos. So that's how I celebrated. And then after that, I had a bit of a party. But we were busy launching a BMID, so there was not really much time for anything else.
So how do you go now? So you're now supervising students yourself. So what have you taken from your experiences in whole that you now incorporate in your own supervision kind of technique, so your whole career that you're now using for those future leaders and PhD students?
I think having been a caseload midwife is really, really helpful here, because you have to realise that there's no one size fits all, and that you adapt the way you provide PhD supervision according to the needs of the student. So some students will need something very different to others, but you have, it's like the sitting in the corner knitting, or the hands on. So you're hands on when you need to be, and you sit in the corner and knit when you need to, but you keep a very, very watchful eye over the whole process, and you don't let interference come in. And you don't let too much unnecessary intervention come in, and you keep people grounded and focused and eyes on the ball. And I think it's around enabling it to be their study. Mm-hmm. And you don't want them to say at the end of it that I couldn't have done it without you. You want them to acknowledge what they've achieved. And if you do too much, they're not going to get that sense of acknowledgement. And if you do too little, they're not. So I think it's a balance. The other thing that I think is really important is to work really, really well with your co-supervisors and have very, very strong lines of communication. Because if you don't, exactly the same as with fragmented care for women, It's the woman who falls out of the net when you've got fragmented care. And if you've got a disconnect between supervisors, it's the poor student that ends up confused and unsupported. And so I think that, it's around individualized care. And I think, I don't think it's wrong to say care. I think you've got to care about your student. You've got to want their best interests to prevail. You've got to do some pastoral support or guide them where that pastoral support might be obtained. And I suppose having all done the wellness work helps with that. But you've also at times got to be tough, and you've got to set boundaries, and I think if you establish that at the very beginning so they know what they're getting into, and set your expectations, it's exactly the same as when you go into a relationship with a woman when you're providing continuity of care.
I love that analogy. I think that's brilliant. What do you get out of being a supervisor?
I just love watching people grow. Not only do I love watching people grow, I love watching the knowledge base grow, and I love generating the evidence. But I think it's when people realise that they can do it, and that they get that sense of empowerment and that realisation that how important this is. How important it is, and I hope that they go on and inspire others and do that waking up that I had happened to me all those years ago. So it doesn't mean if you're not doing research or you're not doing, it doesn't mean you're not a fantastic midwife. And if all you do is listen, if you're willing to listen and you're willing to consider then job done.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. It's been great, Liz. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today. You'll find all the links on Twitter, Instagram, and on the podcast website. If you are a midwife and you would like to share your research, your postgraduate studies, or even the quality improvement projects you are doing now, then email me at throughthepinard@gmail.com. Send me a tweet or send me a DM.